I suppose most of you know I didn't make it on the first try. My voice didn't sound anything like this at that time. I had a cold and flu, so it just didn't work out. But I'm kind of privileged to be with you this evening. Before we begin our talk this evening, our experiences, let's just bow our heads for a word of prayer. Heavenly Father, we thank you and we praise you for your goodness, your mercy upon us. Father, you've given us another day, a day of blessing, a day of responsibilities. And Father, now as we've come to this congregation, this part of your moral vineyard, these people of yours, we pray, Lord, that your Spirit would be with us as we speak to them, that they might receive a blessing, that they might receive a challenge to be faithful to you, the true and living God. But most of all, Father, it's our desire that you would receive the honor and glory. For we realize, Lord, that it's only you and you only that have done these things. Father, we pray that as we look forward to these end times we're living in, that we might endeavor to live for you. Realizing, Lord, that there's darkness around us, and not only physical darkness such as we have outside, but there's spiritual darkness on every hand, and we're reminded of what your word says, that in the end times there shall be perilous times coming. And even though there may be trials and tests in our life, we realize, Lord, that greater is He that is in us than He that is in the world. And Father, you have told us through your Son that you would never leave us nor forsake us, whether it be in time of peace, whether it be in time of war. Father, you would be there to guide and to direct and to bless. And so, Father, as we worship you tonight, may we be worshiping you in spirit and in truth and in honor and glory to you. In Christ's name we pray. Amen. One of our favorite psalms that was in our family is Psalm 91. And I would like to read a few verses of that psalm. He that dwelleth in the secret place of the Most High shall abide under the shadow of the Almighty. I will say of the Lord, He is my refuge and my fortress. My God, in Him will I trust. Surely He shall deliver thee from the snare of the fowler and from the noisome pestilence. He shall cover thee with His feathers, and under His wings shalt thou trust. His truth shall be thy shield and buckler. Thou shalt not be afraid for the terror by night, nor for the arrow that flieth by day, nor for the pestilence that walketh in darkness, nor for the destruction that wasteth at noonday. 1,000 shall fall at thy side, and 10,000 at thy right hand, but it shall not come nigh thee. Only with thine eyes shalt thou behold and see the reward of the wicked. Because thou hast made the Lord, which is my refuge, even the Most High, thy habitation, there shall no evil befall thee, neither shall any plague come nigh thy dwelling. For he shall give his angels charge over thee to keep thee in all thy ways. They shall bear thee up in their hands, lest thou dash thy foot against a stone. Thou shalt tread upon the lion and adder, the young lion and the dragon shalt thou trample under feet. Because he hath set his love upon me, therefore will I deliver him. I will set him on high, because he hath known my name. He shall call upon me, and I will answer him. I will be with him in trouble. I will deliver him and honor him. With long life will I satisfy him and shew him my salvation. And I'm wondering, has that psalm been a reality in your life? It certainly was in the life of our family. I was born in Yugoslavia, a country which is located in the Balkan Peninsula, in the southeastern part of Europe, sometime before the Second World War. I won't tell you exactly how many years before the Second World War. But nevertheless, just to give you an idea about Yugoslavia, I'm not sure how many of you really know much about Yugoslavia, although many of you, if you have read the newspapers and heard the news the last several years, realized that there was a great civil war raging in Yugoslavia when the Serbs were fighting against the Croats and the Bosnians. You see, just to give you a little background, perhaps that would help you. The reason that civil war was going on like that was because during the 1400s, the Turks overran Yugoslavia. At that time, it was called the Kingdom of Serbia. And the Serbs were occupying it, but the Turks, who were very fierce fighters, came and overran Yugoslavia, and they occupied it. They conquered the Serbs, and they occupied it for over 400 years. And during that time, the Turks were very vicious, ruthless. They slew many people. Finally, in 1896, a man by the name of Mihailović, who was a great general, got a group together, and they overthrew the Turks. They drove them out again. But for some reason, in the southwestern or south central part of Yugoslavia, the king who was established at that time allowed some of the Muslims and some of the Turks — the Turks, by the way, were all Muslims — they allowed them to get some land, and they lived there for many years. But Bosnia-Herzegovina, as we knew it in Yugoslavia, was always a thorn in the flesh of the Serbs. And so the First World War began, and that kind of held things together. And not long after that, the Second World War began, and again, Yugoslavia had to concentrate on fighting the outside forces. Then after the Second World War, Broz Tito became a dictator of Yugoslavia. Now, even though Broz Tito was a communist, he was a very charismatic man, and he had ruled Yugoslavia quite well, even though he was a communist. It was far better than it was in Russia. But being a charismatic leader that he was able to hold Yugoslavia together. And there was no war, even though there was an underlying, almost like kind of like a bed of coals there, you know. There was always that hatred between the Serbs and the Muslims. And then finally, after the death of Tito in 1980, it started developing and developing and developing, and finally it flared up and into a civil war. And so that's where the civil war come from, and that's why the Serbs had such hatred for the Muslims, because — and I'm not saying this that I agree with what they did, not at all — but that's where the hatred came from. And so you have an idea why there was such great fighting going on in Yugoslavia in the last few years. And that's why the Serbs were so vicious against the Muslims, because they realized, they knew that these Muslims were really not in their own country. They belonged back in Turkey, and they had the country that, or the land that they had taken away from the Serbs to begin with. That's just a little bit of a background concerning what took place in the last few years in Yugoslavia. But we want to go back much further than that, not necessarily 1400, but at the turn of the century, even before the turn of the century, in about the 1890s, Yugoslavia is mostly mountainous. We have the Crna Gora, as we call them. They were called the Black Mountains in Montenegro. And then there is, even in Bosnia, there's a lot of mountain areas. But there is a rich, fertile valley, which is located between the two main rivers in Yugoslavia, the Sava River and the Danube River. The Danube River, of course, being the more famous one. It starts in the Black Forest area of Germany. Well, this fertile valley was located there in Yugoslavia, but it was not being farmed, because the Serbs, being under the Turkish rule — that was after the Turkish rule, after the Turks were driven out — but the Serbs were not farmers. They did not like farming. That was not what they liked to do. And so the king who was established after the overthrow of the Turks realized, in order to have a prosperous country, you've got to have agriculture. And I'm sure you've heard it many times, even in here in the United States, that agriculture is the backbone of any country. If you don't have a rich agriculture, if you can't grow your own food, you're done for. You can't exist. And so, realizing that, he sent word to neighboring countries, inviting anybody who wanted to come to Yugoslavia, and they had to be farmers, they had to farm, that he would allow them to get as much land as they could properly farm, and they would have this land. And so, word was sent into the Schwarzwald area, or the Black Forest area, actually where the Danube River began. And there, word was heard by my great-grandparents. And they decided they were going to go to Yugoslavia and claim some of this land in order to be farmers. They were farmers to begin with. And so they got on boats in Germany. As a matter of fact, they got on the Danube River when it got wide enough. And they traveled down on these flat boats down the Danube River through Austria and Hungary down into Yugoslavia. And they settled in this low fertile valley near a small town called Kupinovo. Now, Kupinovo may sound strange to you, but if you remember two English words, you'll remember Kupinovo. The words mean by new. Kupi means by, and Novo means new. Now, it doesn't mean that we bought everything new, but I thought that would help you to remember the place where I came from. There, my grandmother was born, and there, my father was born into a family. My great-grandparents acquired approximately 500 acres of land. They planted orchards and vineyards, and the rest was farmed as regular farming land. And for a number of years, we became farmers, and we got along real well with the Serbs living in the area. But one thing that is quite different in Europe, most of the European countries, than it is here in the United States is the fact the United States is known as a melting pot. You know, we have a diversity of languages, a diversity of nationalities, but we're all Americans. Now, as I said, my grandmother was born in Yugoslavia, my father was born in Yugoslavia, but we were always known as the Njemačke. The Njemačke meant the Germans. We were always the Germans. And in our home, though, our language, our German language, is kept up. As a matter of fact, my mother spoke four different languages. My father spoke three different languages. My grandmother spoke four different languages as well. So there was a diversity of languages. And even though we got along quite well with our neighbors, we were still the Germans. And my father was a big, husky young man. He was bigger than I am. He was about 6'2", weighed about 260 pounds. And he was very strong. But yet he was very gentle. And in the neighborhood, he was known as someone who was a real good arbitrator between people who had arguments. Of course, being the size he was, nobody argued with him too much. One of the events that took place, and he always wanted to be known as the best. He had a problem with that. My younger brother has that same problem. I do sometimes too. But nevertheless, one day as they were reaping the corn, and by the way, they didn't have any corn pickers or harvesters of any kind. They just simply cut it with a sickle, with a scythe, and then they bunched it together like some of the farmers do around here, some of the Amish farmers. And then they husked it later on. Well, there was another young fellow that was hired in our family who was also helping with the harvest of corn. And he was also pretty husky, and he thought he was also pretty good. And so my father challenged him to race across the field to see who could get to the other end the quickest. Well, they started out. And of course, you know what the saying goes, haste makes waste, and you could become a little careless. And as they were racing across that field to see who could get to the other end the quickest, my father cut himself with that sickle in his left kneecap. Just a slight scratch, he says. And he didn't pay much attention to it. He just kept right on going, and he did beat the other young man. And then after the day's work was done, my father still didn't pay too much attention to that little cut in his left knee. And there was a dance in the local area, and my father, who was about 20 years of age at that time, a little bit less than 20 years of age, decided he was going to go to the dance. But they had to carry him home. By the time he was finished at that dance, his leg had swollen to such a capacity that they had to cut his pants leg off of him in order to undress him. And they put him to bed, and he realized that blood poison had set into his leg. He was taken to a hospital. Of course, in those days, they didn't have any kind of help for that sort of thing. And they had to amputate his left leg. And my father, who weighed 260 pounds at one time, went down to 95 pounds. And in order to make matters worse, he contracted pneumonia after he had his amputation. And they sent him home to die. There was no hope for him, and he said, "I want to go home to die." Well, he was laying in the bedroom of my grandparents' home, which was a 12-room house. And there were two young ladies who were part of a fellowship in Kupinova. They were part of the Pentecostal congregation. And they came to my grandmother and they asked if they could pray for Micha or Michael. And my grandmother, who was also a believer at that time, part of that same congregation, said, "Well, you go and ask Micha, see what he has to say." So they went into the bedroom and they asked my father if they could pray for him. And my father, as I mentioned, was not a believer. He had not accepted Jesus Christ. But he was not an unbeliever in the same terms. And so he said, "Well, sure, go ahead." And so these two young ladies knelt down in front of at the bedside and they began to pray for my father. And they prayed earnestly for him that God might allow him to live. And even though the doctors had told him there was no possible way, with all the loss of weight that he had and the run-down condition and plus having pneumonia, there was no possibility that he could live. My father did live. And one of those two young ladies, Julia Drozdzik, became a mother. After my father recovered, that was later on, of course, that she became a mother. After my father recovered, and the bloom of youth was starting to get a hold of him again, and springtime was coming, he forgot all about the fact that these two young ladies had prayed for him, and it was a miracle of God that he recovered. But it was springtime, and my father loved bees. Now, you, of course, realize that when you have orchards, you must have bees in order to have your trees pollinated. My father always kept a lot of bees around. But I must admit, I never liked them. My father could scoop into his beehive and scoop out bees by the handful. But if I heard a bee buzzing around my head, I took off. But our neighbor man, came to my father and said that there was a swarm of bees had settled in a tree a short distance away, and he was wondering if my father would be interested. And of course, my father was always interested in bees. And so he hobbled. He had made himself a kind of a crutch. And he hobbled along and wanted to see where this swarm of bees was. And it was a little further away from from our estate where my grandparents lived. And so he decided he wasn't going to hobble all the way back to get his bee equipment in order to catch the swarm. Instead, he decided to go to another neighbor man, who he knew that also kept bees, and so he decided to ask him for his equipment in order to capture this swarm. And he knocked on the door, and the Lord works in mysterious ways. And what he didn't realize was that at that very moment, there was a prayer meeting going on at that house. Because the man who lived there, the man and his wife, the man was a minister of the Pentecostal congregation. And they had a little meeting there, and they had a prayer meeting, and when they heard the knock, they opened the door, and there stood Micha. And they were overjoyed because they thought that he had come to join them in the prayer meeting. My father was too embarrassed to tell them that really he had no intention of coming in the prayer meeting. But they invited him in, and so he went in. And by the way, Julia Drozdzik, my future mother, was there. And she was overjoyed to see him, and the Lord used that occasion to lead my father to him, and my father accepted Jesus Christ at that time. And so I had a family of believers My grandmother was a believer. My mother was a believer. My father was a believer. My grandfather wasn't, which was very sad. But as I mentioned, we got along well. Life was good. But something happened toward the end of the 1930s. Something that changed the whole picture, not only of our neighborhood, but the whole picture of Yugoslavia, as well as all of Europe and most of the world. The Second World War began. A man by the name of Adolf Hitler took possession of Germany. He became the Chancellor of Germany. Now, I want to tell you something. In the beginning, Adolf Hitler was a very good man. He was a terrific leader. He knew how to bring Germany out of the deepest depression that it had ever known and bring it out to become one of the greatest great nations in Europe. But the sad fact of it is he did it but through war. And even though Hitler was a chancellor in Germany and he was very popular, he was not satisfied to be a dictator only of Germany. But he had a slogan which maybe some of you older ones had heard. The slogan was, and it's in German, Deutschland, Deutschland über alles, über alles in der Welt. Germany, Germany over everything in the world. And he started out to become that kind of a dictator. And in order to become that kind of a dictator, of course, he had to conquer nations. He moved into Poland. He overran Poland, being one of the most brutal men that ever conquered a nation. From Poland, he moved on to Czechoslovakia, down into Austria, to the southeast of him. Austria was no match for Hitler's war machinery, because Hitler by this time had a huge war machine running. And Austria was just a small country. And so they just simply gave up in order to save lives. After he conquered Austria, the next move was to go down in the Balkan Peninsula. The first country in the Balkan Peninsula, of course, was Yugoslavia. And he came from the northern part. He came into Yugoslavia. Yugoslavia, at that time, in that moment, did not have much of an army to fight against him. But something happened as well in Yugoslavia, just about the same time, that changed the picture as well. A man by the name of Broz Tito also had designs on becoming a dictator. He wanted to become a dictator of Yugoslavia. He was satisfied with Yugoslavia. But he realized that he himself was not going to be able to overthrow the Serbian army. And so he went into Russia, and there he was taught the art of guerrilla warfare. The guerrilla warfare is far different than regular warfare. The fact is that you can take a small band of men and you can ambush just small contingents of an army and overthrow them, and by that weakening your enemy a little bit at a time. They might have taken or blown up a train or something like that, or blown up some bridges, or doing all kinds of damage to the country until it became weak enough and you became strong enough that you could overthrow the country. And so the first thing that he had to do was to get rid of the government. And so he went into Belgrade. He came up from the east, went up into Belgrade, into the capital, and there he overthrew the government. At that time we had a monarchy. We had a king who was ruler of Yugoslavia. And the king was assassinated. His successor fled for his life into Spain. Prince Peter, who was to become the king, fled into Spain, and they went to exile. And all of a sudden, the whole country was in a chaos. At the same time that the king was overthrown, another contingent or another group arose, which we called the Chetniks, or the Loyalists. The Loyalists vowed that they would not shave their faces or cut their hair until a king was put on the throne again. And so it was very easy to recognize a Chetnik or a Loyalist because he usually had long hair and a long beard. Now we had Germany, the German, or the Niemeckes, the German army coming down from the north. Hitler and his band of guerrillas, or partisans as we call them, coming from the east. And then within the country itself, we had the Loyalists. And so we had three different armies fighting at the same time. And as they came into our area in the central part of Yugoslavia, we never knew who had full control of the area. But many times during the night, a knock might come on the door. And the man of the house would go to the door, and there would stand a soldier. I mean, he may have been a communist, or he may have been a Chetnik, or he may have been a German. But whoever he was, he would ask you, he said, "Are you for my cause? Are you for the communists, for instance?" And the man of the house had better agree that he was. Otherwise, he was taken away and never heard from again. Many men lost their lives that way. My grandfather, even though he was not a Christian, was a very honest man. And being that honest was to his undoing. One evening, he was at the local bar. And with his buddies and his friends, he was there drinking. And even though he knew it was very dangerous, but drink had muddled his brain and loosened his tongue, he turned around and he looked around in the group that was there and he said, "You know," he said, "I hate communism and I hate communists." And then he started out for home. But he never made it home. He was ambushed on the way. He was stabbed and shot to death. My grandmother was living by herself at that time. My father had married by this time. It moved into a small house in Kupinovo, and you'll see a picture of that house. And there he lived, and there was four children, four boys and a girl, five children actually, that were born into that family. But after the communist or the fighting started, the communists took control of our area. My father, as I mentioned, liked bees. He thought that it was pretty peaceful around, so he decided that he could load some of his bees up on a wagon with some help, and he would take them into a local area in the woods where the acacia tree was blooming. Our fruit trees were done blooming. The acacia tree bloomed later on. And the acacia tree is very similar to the locust tree that you have around here. And as he was watching the bees at work, he was standing alongside the wagon, and he just loved to watch his bees at work. All of a sudden, he heard a whistle. At first, he didn't pay much attention to the whistle. He thought it was a bird. But then he heard that whistle again, and listening a little closer, he realized it didn't sound quite like a bird. And knowing that the communists had their strongholds in the woods, he realized that he might have been in danger. And looking around, all of a sudden, he was hit from the back and knocked down. And as he fell on the ground, a communist soldier jumped on his chest and stuck his bayonet at his throat and said, "I'm going to kill you because you're a spy." And even though the bayonet was at his throat, my father realized that if he plunged that bayonet in, it was the end of his life. But he also knew that the next moment he'd be with his Lord. He was very calm. He said, "No," he said, "I'm not a spy." He said, "I'm just here with my bees." The one that was kneeling on his chest asked him, he said, "Where are you from?" And he said, "Kupinovo." Well, he said, "I'll soon find out if you're telling the truth." And he called out in the woods, and soon my father was surrounded by about a dozen masked soldiers. The one that was kneeling on his chest called out, he said, "Is there anybody here from Kupinovo?" And the man stepped forward. He was masked. My father couldn't tell who he was. But he looked down at my father, and the one that was kneeling on his chest said, "Do you know this man?" And he said, "Oh yes," he said, "I know him." He said, "That's Misha Fodor." He said, "He's a good man. He's a German, but he said, he's a good man." He said, "You can let him go." And so they helped my father get up and helped him get up on the wagon, and my father started out to go home. And even though he knew the area quite well, he realized that he was lost. He came back to just about the same spot where he started out. And trying again, he realized that he just couldn't find his way out of the woods. And so he laid the reins of the horses down alongside of him, and he prayed. He said, God, you lead these horses home. And the horses took him home. There was a constant battle and fighting going on. One of the things each of the armies that did as they took over an area, they would get the most able, available men and force them to go into their army. And so, when the communists took over our area, they forced the most available young men to go in their army. When the Germans took over, they did the same thing. Our neighbor man was forced to go into the communist army, and when the Germans took over, my two uncles were forced to go into the German army. And so many times there was neighbors actually fighting against each other. Another thing that each of the armies did was that when they took over an area, they would pick out the most prominent citizens or anyone that would oppose their cause, and they would execute them. When the Germans took over our area, they gathered up all the citizens that were against the Germans, and they walked them to an area called the Obechka Bara. And you'll see a picture of that Obechka Bara after a while. They walked them to the bank of that Obechka Bara. The Obechka Bara was actually a swamp area. Every spring, the Sava River, which flowed very close to Kupinova, would overflow, and as it receded, as it ebbed away, it would leave a swamp area, mud, there. The Germans gathered up about a dozen people from our town, and then they invited the people of the town to come and to watch and to see what would happen to anybody that would oppose the Germans. And then they mounted machine guns on the banks of the Obechka Bara. Then they would tell those people to start running into that swamp. Of course, those people didn't get very far because they bogged down. And as they bogged down, the German soldiers would open fire with their machine guns, and they would mow them down. And they would just leave them lay in that swamp area to rot. The communists, not to be outdone, wanted to do the same thing. And one time when the communists took over our area, they found a man who was a Chetnik, a loyalist. But he was not an active fighter. He was an old man. He was a Christian. But he was loyal to the former government. There was nothing wrong with that. But he was very easy to identify because he had a long beard and long hair. And so they decided to make an example of him. They built a platform at the corner of the street that we lived on. And they also invited all the people of the town to come and watch. And I, as a youngster of 7 years of age, stood there in front of that platform watching. I had no idea what was going to take place, but it didn't take long to find out. On the platform, they put a chair and they seated that old man, the Chetnik, on the chair. Opposite of him on that platform sat a communist officer, a partisan. And various people came walking up to that platform and they accused that old man of all kinds of misdeeds that he would have done against the government. All of them, of course, I'm sure, were trumped up. They were lies. They walked up there and they accused that old man, and after a while, after all the witnesses were gone, the communist officer sitting across from him pointed his finger at him. He said, I find you guilty of treason against the government, punishable by death. But they didn't take him out and shoot him. That was too easy. Instead, several partisans jumped up on the platform and they walked up to that old man and they grabbed a hold of a few strands of hair of his beard and they began to pull. And they pulled. And they pulled until his whole beard was pulled off. And when they were finished, his face was a bloody, pulpy mess. But brethren and sisters, do you realize that our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ suffered the same kind of fate? Not because he was guilty. Not because he had done anything wrong, but he did it for you and I. After they pulled that old man's beard off, he was still very much alive. And so these partisans called out in the crowd and somebody threw some shepherd's clubs to them. Clubs that were about 5 to 6 feet high and had a big knot on the end. And they took these clubs and they swung them like bats. And they beat that old man until he laid up there on that platform and seemed that he was dead. But that wasn't good enough for them. The officer called out again and someone brought a wagon and horses. And they took that body and they tied him feet first in back of that wagon. And one of the communist soldiers jumped up on that wagon and they raced all over town. When they were finished, his body was all dragged to pieces. It was a show of force to anybody that would oppose communism. Even though the communists had control of our area, the Germans wanted to conquer it, and so they sent a contingent of an army and they began to fight. And the battle was raging all around us. And the Germans were gaining the upper hand. They were driving the communists out. And because our neighbor lady's husband was in the Serbian army or in the communist army, she realized that if the Germans took control of our area and they found out that her husband was in the communist army, it could mean certain death for her and her children. And so as the battle was raging all around us, she crept with her three little children across her backyard and our backyard and knocked on the door. And my father thought it was another time that a soldier was going to be standing there. But as he opened the door, he saw a neighbor lady and he invited her in. And she and her children and our family gathered together in our bedroom to wait the end of the battle. And as we were waiting there, all of a sudden, the window of that bedroom was broken in. And as we looked up, there stood a German soldier and he was holding his submachine gun, pointing it into the room. In the German language, he said, "I have a notion to kill all of you in here." And my mother got up off the bed that she was sitting on, and she started walking toward that German soldier, facing him, looking him in the eyes. And she began to plead for the life of the people that were in that room. And she asked him if perhaps he didn't have some little children back home in Germany that were just as innocent as the children in that room. Or that perhaps he might have a mother or a father back home who were just as innocent as the people in that room. And why would he want to kill innocent people? And she continued walking until she stood directly in front of that submachine gun being held by a war-crazed soldier, never knowing when he'd squeeze that trigger and kill her and all the people that were in it. And it wasn't until many years later, when I was more grown up, that I realized how much grace it takes for a person to walk directly toward the machine gun being held by a war-crazed soldier, never knowing when he'd squeeze that trigger and kill you. She was willing to risk her life for the people in that room. Germans took control of our town, but as they drove the communists back, the communists had to flee very quickly. At the edge of our town, there was a hospital. That hospital was used the same as any other hospital during peaceful times. But as the communists were fleeing, they had many wounded soldiers, and they decided they were going to use that hospital as a hiding place, put their soldiers in, their wounded soldiers in. In the basement of that hospital, they stored some ammunition. Some days later, the Germans found out about the hospital. We lived nearby to that hospital. We could see that hospital from the house we lived in. And we were Germans. The Germans found out about the hospital and they went into that hospital and took all the nurses and the doctors out of it. Any civilians that were left in it, they took out. Only the wounded soldiers were left in. Then the Germans surrounded that hospital with men with submachine guns. Then they took straw and put it around the walls of that hospital. And they lit the straw. And the hospital caught fire. And as that fire reached the men that were in that hospital, they began to scream. And we heard the screams. But any man that would jump out of any window or any door meant certain death as well. Some did try it. They were shot to death. And the rest were left inside to burn to death. And when the fire reached the basement of that hospital where the ammunition was stored, it just simply blew up. It blew up all the soldiers that were in it. But the reason I said that we lived close to that hospital and we were Germans was on purpose. Because the next day, a young man approached my father, who was a good friend of his, and my father often felt it was the same man that identified him in the woods. He came to him and he said, "Mike, by the way, a lot of the communist soldiers were soldiers at night, civilians during the day. That's why you never knew who you could trust." His friend walked up to my father and he said, "Mike, Micha, you know that hospital burned last night? Our wounded soldiers either burned to death or were shot to death. We lost a lot of ammunition. Micha, you're being accused of telling the Germans about the hospital. Tonight, we're going to come for you. We're going to execute you." My father knew very well that when they made a threat, they were going to carry it out. And the only resource he had was to go to the German army and ask for help. The commander of the patrol that was in town at that time said that they realized, they had found out that the communists were going to have a great offensive against our town that night and that they weren't going to be able to hold them because they didn't have enough men. And he said, "Instead of losing my men, we're going to pull out. So this afternoon, we're pulling out, and if you want to go along with us, you'd better get ready." And so my father got a wagon and horses ready. And as the afternoon approached, the communists didn't wait for nightfall to attack. Instead, they attacked in the afternoon, trying to catch the Germans by surprise, and they just about did. And the Germans quickly pulled out of town, and as they pulled out of town, we pulled out with them. And we went to our neighboring town called Bechmen, which was a stronghold of the Germans. That night, since they couldn't get my father, they got my grandmother instead. My grandmother lived a few miles out of town, and because the fighting had started, we had every intention of going for my grandmother and taking her along. Because the fighting was raging all around us, we couldn't go and get my grandmother. And so that night, she was arrested by the communists. And she was locked up in a pig pen for 7 days and seven nights. During that time, she was brought in for questioning many different times. They wanted her to admit the fact that her son was a traitor, and that way she would be the mother of a traitor, and they'd have just cause to put her to death. But my grandmother would never admit it. But one time, she was brought in for questioning, and she was brought into a large room. At one end of the room, there was a large mounted on that table was a machine gun. I don't know how many of you have ever seen a machine gun, but it's a very ugly weapon. It stands on a tripod between 2 and 3 feet high. It has a barrel between 4 and 6 inches in diameter with holes all around it. And at the squeeze of the trigger, just one squeeze of the trigger, up to 600 bullets a minute can spit out of the end of that machine gun. It can literally cut a person in half. There was a young officer sitting behind the table, and he motioned my grandmother to come forward. Standing behind the machine gun was a communist soldier. As my grandmother walked up in front of the table, he told her to look down at the floor. My grandmother looked at the floor, and she saw that the floor was splattered with blood. Many people had lost their life in front of that machine gun. Then that young officer looked at my grandmother, and he said, "Grandma, I'm going to question you, and if you don't answer my questions to my satisfaction, all I have to do is nod my head at my comrade over here, and he'll squeeze that trigger, and Grandma, you're going to be dead." My grandmother, who was a child of God, looked at that young man with all the love of God shining out of her eyes, and she said, "Young man, there's something I want to tell you." She said, "Yes, you can kill my body, but you can't hurt my soul. That belongs to God." And that soldier realized that he couldn't scare my grandmother into a confession. And so, he sent her back to her pig pen jail. There my grandmother joined her neighbor lady, who was also arrested. And my grandmother had the privilege of leading her neighbor lady to the Lord while they were imprisoned there in that pig pen. But then he called the guard that was guarding my grandmother and the neighbor lady, and he gave him orders to take them out during the darkness of night and walk them to the Obechkabara, to shoot them at the edge and dump them down into the swamp. Because he couldn't have a public execution, he still wanted to get rid of them. When that guard came back to that pig pen jail, he did something which was quite contrary to his orders. He told my grandmother what he was told to do. But he said, "You know," he said, "I've heard you sing, and I've heard you pray, and I realize that you have a peace that I don't know anything about. He said, "I just don't have the heart to kill you. I just can't kill such devout women." But he said, "I'm going to have to do something." And so he said, "We're going to walk out tonight. I'm going to walk you to the Obechkabara, and I'm going to release you." As darkness came, he woke up my grandmother and the neighbor lady. They went to sleep even during that time. Reminds me a little bit of Peter, doesn't it? When he was in jail. He started to walk through town. The soldier was walking with his gun pointed at their backs. Two women were walking in front of him. They knew exactly where to walk. They had been past the Obechkabara many times. They walked straight to the Obechkabara. Then the soldier told him, "Stop." He said, When I say to you, run, I want you to run." He waited a little bit and he said, "Ladies, run." The neighbor lady and my grandmother had made up their mind that they were going to run in two different directions. If he was going to shoot them, he'd have to aim twice. And the grandmother ran one way and the neighbor lady ran the other way, and the soldier raised his rifle and he shot in the air. The neighbor lady and my grandmother escaped. The grandmother went to some friends that were living in the area, and word was sent to my father that his mother was released. We had known that she was arrested, and I'm sure prayers went up all the time for her safety. And even though the price of death was on my father's head, he hitched the horses that night, and he came back in the darkness of night, and he picked up his mother, and he brought her to be with us. Bechmen was a stronghold of the Germans. But the Germans, Hitler himself, was spreading his army very thin. And so, consequently, the communists were gaining strength, and they decided they were going to attack this town. They thought that the Germans were weak enough to overcome. But the Germans found out about it. And they took sandbags, and at every street corner, they put these sandbags around huge machine guns. These were some of the biggest they had. And the communists attacked. And the battle lasted 2 days and two nights. We looked out in the out of our bedroom windows, and we could see those barrels of those machine guns glowing in the dark. After the battle was over, the Germans announced the Germans won the battle. The Germans announced that 1,500 communist soldiers lost their life in those 2 days and two nights of battle. They got wagons and they loaded up the bodies of those soldiers on those wagons. A huge trench was dug at the edge of town. And they just simply dumped those bodies in there and covered them up. It was one of the great decisive battles fought in Yugoslavia. But Hitler was still spreading his armies thinner. Now, most of Europe was fighting against him. Britain was fighting against him, and U.S., America declared war against him. And he had to pull his armies out. And so it was told us that anybody wanted to leave the area that the Germans were going to pull out of Bechmann. But they told us just simply to get enough food together, enough clothing together to last for 2 weeks. After 2 weeks, we'd be able to return back to our homes again, and we'd be able to regain all of our properties again. And so in September 1944, word was sent to us, get ready. And so we loaded up our wagons with enough food to last 2 weeks, and we headed out. We met at the edge of town. There was a German soldier given to us to lead us out of the area. There was about 100 wagons that gathered together in the darkness of night to pull out. So we started out. We went past some woods. As I mentioned before, it was in the woods that the communists had their strongholds. That's where they were hiding out. And some of the communists came out and they attacked the back part of the wagon train. And they shot the horses in order to stop the wagons. And they jumped on the wagon and began to kill the husbands and the wives and the children. And we heard their screams and their cries for help. But there wasn't anything we could do. We just simply beat our horses as hard as we could and got out of the area. And in the morning, the wagon train stopped, and we took count and we saw that one-third of the wagon train hadn't made it past the woods. The only thing we could do was keep on going. We were on the road for 2 weeks, and we ran out of food. A horse died along the way, and it was butchered, and we ate the meat, and we thought it was delicious, but it didn't go very far. And so the husbands, the men stopped the wagons along the road. And the women would get off the wagons and pull grass along the road and cook it. And we would drink the broth and eat the grass for sustenance. When we came to the Hungarian border, we were heading north toward Austria. We came to the Hungarian border, the German soldier said that he had to return to his unit again. But we were just to keep on heading north. We would travel through Hungary, and we would come into Austria. And the Austrian government had promised to give us a place to stay. And so he turned away and went back to his unit, and we began heading north. We started into Hungary, and we went down a long, sloping hill. And in distance, we heard the drone of airplanes. We didn't know whether they were friend or foe, but it didn't take long to find out. Those airplanes started to dive at our wagon train and began to shoot. This time we were in the back of the wagon train, and my father told us to jump off the wagons and lay down in the gutter along the road. Those in front of the wagon train were close to a bridge, and they jumped off their wagons and went underneath the bridge for protection. Once more, the wagons were shot up. Men and women were killed and wounded. We saw as they were diving down at us that it was really the dreaded dive bombers that shook us. The attack lasted perhaps just a few minutes, but it seemed like a long time. And then we looked up and we saw that they were leaving, and we thought we were rejoicing that the attack was over. But one of those airplanes swung around and came back and began to dive down at that bridge. And as it dove down, it dropped the bomb on that bridge, blowing up the bridge and all the people that were under it. We waited. The airplanes had left, but the devastation was terrible. Men took whatever they had, shovels, whatever they could find, and dug ditches, dug holes along the road to bury the dead. Women tore up bed sheets and bound up the wounds of those that were injured. And we took count, and we saw that another third of the wagon train was gone. The rest of us knew the only thing we could do was keep on going. And so we kept on going, heading north. We came to a Hungarian farm. Because it was cold and wet by this time, it was in October. And Octobers were pretty much like they are here in Pennsylvania, cold, wet, and dreary. And we became wet, and we wanted the place to warm up and just dry off a little bit. We had slept in our wagons for over 4 weeks now. And so my mother, being able to speak Hungarian, approached the farmer, the Hungarian farmer and his wife, and asked if we could stay in their barn overnight. And they left us stay. Some of us slept up on the hayloft, some down with the cattle. And we thought it was a palace. It was dry and warm. Morning came, and with it the realization that we had to keep on going. And so, the men and women started getting back on their wagons. My family started getting back on the wagon also. But one of the boys in our family decided he wasn't getting on quite yet. Instead, he walked around a little bit. And he walked in back of the barn. And in back of the barn, there was a rabbit hutch. And inside there were some rabbits hopping around. He looked around, didn't see anybody, and saw that the rabbit hutch wasn't locked. There was no latch on it. And so he quickly opened the door of that rabbit hutch and reached in and grabbed the little rabbit and stuck him under his coat and got back on the wagon. That little fellow was me. Went to the back of the wagon with this little rabbit under my coat and sat down with my brothers. My mother and father were, my little sister, Elfrida, were sitting up front. My grandmother was sitting next, and we boys were in the back of the wagon. And so my father started out with the wagon train, and we traveled down the road a few miles. But that little rabbit wasn't quiet very long. He started to scratch around and carry on, and my brothers wanted to know what I had. And I told them, I said, I have a little rabbit under my coat. I said, after a while, Daddy can stop the wagon and butcher the rabbit and Mom can cook it, then we can have some meat to eat again. We haven't had any meat for 5 weeks now. We thought it was a good idea. And we were having some fun about it and talking about it, and my mother looked back and she wanted to know what was going on. You know how mothers are. They always want to know what's going on. We tried to convince her that it really wasn't anything, but she came back to investigate, and she discovered the rabbit. And she wanted to know where it came from. And I told her, I said, Mom, back there at the farm, I said, I went back to the barn, and there was this rabbit hutch, and I got a rabbit. I said, after a while, when Daddy stops the wagon, he can butcher the rabbit, and you can cook it for us, and we can have some meat to eat. And my mother taught me a lesson that day that I'll never forget as long as I live. She said, Steve, you can't keep that rabbit. You stole it. It's not yours. She said, it's never right to commit a wrong to supply a need. The tears started rolling down her cheeks. She realized that her children were hungry. She also realized it was wrong. And she stroked my head and she said, "Steve, I'm going to tell Daddy to stop the wagon. You're going to have to give your rabbit away." After a while, my father saw a little boy walking along the road and called me, and I got off the wagon. I walked up to that boy. I gave the rabbit away. And we got back up on the wagon, and we continued living on grass soup as we had before. As you can see, it didn't do me one bit of harm. We arrived in Austria. We were to go in an area called Milchviertel or Mill Quarter. There, a farmer was going to give us a place to live in exchange of some work that my father could do for him and we boys could do for him. But when we arrived there, we found ourselves once more in a war. This time it was the Germans that were fighting against the Americans and their allies, which were the British and the French and the Russians. And above us were the cannons of the Germans and their allies, and below us were the cannons of the Germans as they were retreating. And the shells were flying directly above the farmhouse. But in the basement of that farmhouse, there was a prayer meeting going on. Now, if you ever want to have a real good, effective prayer meeting, you should try it under those conditions. Your prayers really get fervent. And my mother was reading out of the Bible, a Bible that was a real miracle in our home. We see my mother, my grandmother, my father, and my grandfather, they were all literate. They could not read or write. In those days, it was much more important to learn how to work out in the fields than it was to learn how to read and write. So they were never taught to read and write. But after my mother accepted Jesus Christ as her Savior, she had a desire to read God's Word, but she couldn't. One day a friend of hers came to her. This was before my mother was married. Came to her and handed her a Bible. It was written in a Cyrillic script. The Cyrillic script was an outdated script. It was no longer in use in Yugoslavia. She said, "I want to give you this Bible." And my mother looked at it and she said, "I appreciate it." I said, "I can't read it." But she said, "You keep it as a memorial from me. And so my mother put that Bible up on a shelf, and as she went past that Bible day in, day out, her desire to read God's Word became greater and greater all the time. And one day she just simply picked that Bible off the shelf and she knelt down and she prayed. She said, "God, please open my understanding that I'd be able to read your Word." And my mother opened that Bible and she was able to read it. She never learned to read that Bible, but God opened her eyes and she was able to read that Bible. She couldn't read a newspaper. She could, as a matter of fact, we had to teach her to write her name when we came to the United States. But she read that Bible. And that Bible was a real blessing in our family. And she was reading that Bible when the attack was going on all around us. The Americans won the battle. They won the war, of course. And something happened after the war that maybe most of you who have either learned history or are old enough to remember it. After Austria was taken over, there was a meeting between those that had conquered Austria, or driven out the Germans, and it was decided to divide it into four different areas. And each of the conquering armies would receive an area. There were the Americans, the French, the British, and the Russians. And so there were four different zones. There was the Russian zone, the British zone, the American zone, and the French zone. And as it turned out, the area that we lived in became the Russian zone. Once more, it was controlled by communists. Now, for a short period of time, the Americans were there, and we learned to know some GIs, and we had a real good time with them. They were very friendly, very courteous, treated us with respect. It was during that time that I got my first taste of chocolate candy and chewing gum, which I swallowed and got a bellyache from. But then after the Russians took over, it was a completely different story. They were ruthless. Anything they wanted, they would take. And if anybody resisted them, they were either knocked down or they might have even been shot. And so there was a big controversy going on between the Russians and the Austrians. The Austrians were German-speaking people. Russians, of course, spoke a Slavic language. And so they couldn't understand each other. But somehow someone found out about my father being able to speak both those languages. And so he was pressed into the office of interpreter many times as there were some controversies between the Russians and the Austrians. And even though my father tried to leave them under the impression that we were Austrians, native Austrians, when he became an interpreter, the Russians were wondering how he knew the Russian language or the Slavic language. And so one day a officer of the Russian army approached my father and he asked him about it. And my father, being a Christian, of course wouldn't lie about it. And he told him, we actually came from Yugoslavia. And he looked at my father and said, well, why did you ever leave? My father couldn't tell him why he left. They said, we were forced to. He said, the Russian officer said, I'll tell you what, I think you should go back. As a matter of fact, he said, I'm going to see to it that you do. My father knew that if he was sent back, it most likely meant the death of his life and his family's life as well. But he also knew there was no way to get away from the Russian. And so he devised a plan, and he didn't leave anybody know of his plan until it was all over. The day came that we were to go down to the city of Urfar, which was about 20 miles southwest of us, in order to get on the train to travel back down to Yugoslavia. Hired man was to take us down. We loaded our few belongings on the wagon and we headed on down. The Russian officer wanted to make sure we got on the train. And so he sent a Russian soldier along to make sure that we got on the train. We arrived in the city of Urfar. We went to the train station in order to get on the train. My father looked around. He saw opposite of the train station was a trolley station. At the edge of the city of Urfar was the Danube River. On the other side of the Danube River was the city of Linz and also the American zone. Between those two cities was a bridge, and on that bridge traveled the trolley. My father intended to use that trolley to flee to freedom. But there was a problem. There was a Russian soldier to see that we get on the train. There was also the hired man to help us to get on the train. But God took care of both of those problems. The Russian soldier had never been to a big city. And he was very curious. And he wanted to see what the city was like, what it looked like. And so he walked away in order to see the sights of the city. My father looked around and he didn't see that Russian soldier. And he knew that God was working. And so he said to the hired man, he said, we can take care of ourselves. We can get on the train if we have to. We'll unload things right here and you just go back to the farmers. No, you should wait on us. And the hired man agreed. And so he left. And my father looked around once more and still didn't see the Russian soldier. And so instead of going into the trolley or in the train station, we walked across the street and went in the trolley station instead. And there we were approached by, he approached the conductor, asking him to help us cross over the bridge. The conductor looked at my father, and he looked at his wife and his mother and the five little children that were there. And he said, do you realize the consequences of getting caught trying to sneak across the border? I'm not sure my father had heard, or maybe he did. The penalty was to be taken off the trolley train. He would be walked over to the railing of the bridge, shot and dumped into the river. But he also realized that to stay in the American or in the Russian zone sooner or later, we'd get caught again. To go to Yugoslavia meant certain death. And so he said, yes. He said, I know. They said, we're willing to take a chance. The conductor wanted some kind of payment. We didn't have any money. We just had a little bit of food. As a matter of fact, we gave the conductor just about everything we had except for a few bundles of bedclothes. Now, everyone over the age of 14 had to have a pass to go across that bridge. But the Russians were the ones that gave out the passes. And so it was impossible for us to get a pass. So my father was given a conductor's coat, and he was told to stand up front with the engineer and pretend to be a conductor. And I remember my father only had one leg. And so he stood up front with the conductor, or with the engineer. My mother and my grandmother were to lay underneath the bench alongside. The conductor found some women with long dresses. And they sat above my mother and my grandmother, hiding them from view. We boys didn't have any problems. All of us were under the age of 14, and so we could travel without any hindrance, any problem. My little sister, who was about 2 years old at this time, was given to a strange lady to be held. And that lady pretended that this was her little girl. And so we started out. In the middle of the bridge, the train was stopped. The trolley train was stopped. Two Russian guards got on. They walked through the last car. There was three cars to the trolley train. They went through the middle car, checking the passes as they went. And then they came into the front car where our family was. They walked past us boys. They glanced at us. Didn't pay much attention. We were too young. Then they walked past the lady that was holding my little sister, who was quiet throughout the whole trip, even though she was held by a strange lady. And even though we were warned by the conductor, whatever you do, don't look in the direction of your mother or your grandmother, or you might give them away, or certainly not, don't look when they go up to your father. But even though we were warned, we couldn't help it. As those two Russian soldiers began to walk towards where my mother and my grandmother were laying, one up on each side of the trolley train, we thought it couldn't be. From where we were sitting, we could see my mother and my grandmother. And we thought, sure, that they were going to be found out. There was no way these Russian soldiers would miss them. But I believe the miracle of God was beginning to work, and God was beginning to blind their eyes. They continued walking on past. They walked past my mother and my grandmother. And they kept on checking the passes of people as they held them out. And then they went to the front of the trolley train. And we were breathing a sigh of relief as the one guard got off, but the other one didn't. Instead, he looked at my father, and he just stood there and stared. And I'm sure he remembers seeing a conductor of a trolley somewhere throughout that train, and certainly there's usually only one conductor to a trolley train. What was this man doing standing up front here? And so he walked directly in front of my father, and my father turned around and he faced him. And they just stood there and they stared at each other. And then that soldier's gaze went down. And he looked down there where my father's leg should have been, and it wasn't. And he just stared. And then his gaze went back up into his face, and he just stood there. And I'm sure it was no more than just a minute or two. It seemed like an eternity to us. And all of a sudden, it seemed as though a huge hand came out of the heaven and grabbed a hold of that soldier and just simply threw him off that trolley train. He just jumped off that trolley train. He had no more than hit the pavement. The engineer put that car in gear and he sped over to the other side. There was stopped by the Americans. They didn't even bother getting on. They just simply waved us on. We got off at the first station, and before we ever left that platform, our family huddled together, and my father led us in a prayer of thanksgiving. But we realized that God had either blinded the eyes of that soldier, or He had softened his heart, that if He knew that there was something wrong, He didn't take us off the trolley. If we had gained our freedom, but our situation was still pretty desperate. The only thing that we had to our possession were several bundles of bedclothes that we boys could carry over. We had no food. We had no clothing other than what was on our backs. We'd given up on the porch of an open building, and someone saw a Red Cross sign. My mother went into the door, and it was a very busy place. There was a lot of people that were in need after the Second World War. And even though the lady that was there was very sympathetic with our need, she could only share a little bit of food with us, and then she said, "You were going to be on your own." So we took the little bit of food that we had and went out to the open porch of that building, spread out our blankets and sat down on that floor of that open porch and ate our food after we thanked God for it. And there we spent 2 days and two nights. My father had heard about resettlement camps that were being operated by the American Army. And he finally found us a place to live. A truck came along and picked us up and took us to a resettlement camp outside of Linz, Austria. An address that I'll never forget as long as I live. It goes something like this: Lager 65, Baracke 26. Camp 65, Barrack 26. We spent 6 years there in a room that was approximately 9 by 12. It was my little sister got sick while we were there on that porch, and she died. But there was a brother that was born to our family, and so it was a family of eight that lived in a room 9 by 12 for 6 years. That was our living room, our kitchen, our dining room, and our bedrooms. I know what it's like to sleep up on the top of a triple-decker bunk. We became acquainted with some Brethren volunteer service workers that were operating in the area. My oldest brother Frank and I helped to build the Brethren House in Linz, Austria. And there a young man by the name of Donald Dernbaugh came to us. And he said, "How would you people like to go to America?" And that was quite a question. Now, we had learned all about America, and we looked to America as the land that flowed with milk and honey. But we never thought that we'd ever make it. Well, my father says, "You know that I only have one leg, and there's five little boys." An aged grandmother said, "I just don't believe that we can go to America." Well, Donald said, "You just leave that up to me." And so he went to work, and about 2 weeks later, he came along and we loaded up in his little 41 Plymouth that he had over there, and we began our journey to come to the United States. It took about a year to get all of the papers together, and I say still, I must have received about 100 shots during that time. I think I was one of the healthiest people that ever stepped on the shores of the United States. We traveled, finally all the paperwork was done, and we traveled across Germany to the port of Bremerhaven. Now, throughout this whole process, throughout this whole procedure, there were two of the brothers that were exact opposites. One was a pessimist, and the other one was the opposite. Well, we were standing there at the pier. We were to get on board to go to the United States. We were going to get on board a troop carrier, the troop carrier General Muir. And my oldest brother, Frank, who was the optimist, he thought he had the final victory. We were standing there on the gangplank, ready to walk up on that ship, and my brother Frank looks at me and says, Steve, we're going to America. I was the pessimist, excuse me. And I looked at him and I said, "Frank," I said, "you don't know where that ship's going." I said, "It could go anywhere in the world. It doesn't have to go to the United States." I said, "It could go to Canada, South America, even Australia." I said, "You don't know where that ship's going." And he looked at me and just shook his head. He just couldn't believe it. And I said, "Frank, I'll tell you what. We both studied American history and American geography in school. We both know that in New York City or New York Harbor, where we were to arrive, there is the statue called the Statue of Liberty." I said, "Frank, when I see the Statue of Liberty, then I'll admit that we've reached America." When we got on board, it was about 2,000 people on board that ship. We were sleeping in hammocks. It was a troop carrier. We didn't have any cabins. The men were separated from the women. We were on voyage for about 11 days. This was in we got on board on October the 6th, 1951. But after 11 days of voyage, about 2 o'clock in the morning, somebody shook me real rough in my hammock. And I looked up, and there stood my brother Frank. And I said, "Now what's wrong?" He said, "Come on, get dressed. I want to show you something." So I got dressed, and we walked up on the top deck. We walked over to the railing. And my brother Frank pointed over to his left and said, "Steve, look over there." And I looked over in the distance, and there, lighted in beautiful splendor, stood the Statue of Liberty. And I had to admit that we had finally reached the true land of freedom. That was in October the 17th, 1951. It's been my privilege to be a citizen of this land for the past 47 years. God has blessed us. God has blessed you. And this is still the greatest land in the world. Oh, it might not be all that we would like for it to be, but I'll tell you one thing, there is no other country in this world that is any better than this one. God has blessed this land with freedoms that many people only dream about. Freedom from want. You realize that there's 12,000 people starved to death every day, and you and I have plenty of food to eat. Many people meet together like you and I are this evening at the very risk of their lives. You and I have freedoms. Our doors are open. Our windows are not dark, and we can worship God as we see fit. God is still blessing this land. And I don't know what the future may hold. I don't know. God knows. But I do know one thing. The one that has kept us in the past will also keep us in the future. It's my hope and my prayer this evening that as I have told you this story of my family, that you have been blessed, that you have been encouraged, that no matter what comes into your life, God is there. Greater is He that is in you than He that is in the world. We'll take a little intermission now, and I hope you don't get too tired, but I have several slides. In 1978, it was my privilege with another couple, my wife and I and another couple, to go back to my homeland to revisit many of the places, my hometown, the house I lived in, part of our estate, the bridge that we crossed. It was my privilege to see all those things all over again. And I would like to share them with you if you would like to stay. If you feel that you must leave, certainly we understand. That we will need the lights out. Okay. Our trip back began on October the 1st, 1978. Brother Harold Martin and his wife Priscilla and my wife and I started out outside of York, traveling to Kennedy Airport at New York City. Traveling over the Verrazano Narrows Bridge, which was not in existence at the time when we arrived. It was built in 1956, but it is coming across the harbor that we arrived in 1951. We were to fly from New York to Frankfurt, Germany. This is a Lufthansa 747, one of the big, huge planes. We had 325 people on board. You'll have to excuse me, these first few slides are a little blurry. One of the things that our wives did, but they kept a diary of everything as we were going on our trip, and it's very invaluable as you take a trip like this to go along. Excuse me, I want to get back here. Yep. Just a little sidelight here, as we were traveling, if you look over to the left, you just see the left side of Brother Harold. Anyway, as the big, huge airplane was going down the runway, it was revving up its engine, it was vibrating, and I was all excited. It was an exciting time to me to be in such a big airplane. I looked over and Harold was sleeping. I thought, how can a man sleep at a time like this? But he's a world traveler. That was his 142nd flight and my first, so it makes quite a difference. We landed in Frankfurt, Germany, and then rented a car there, a little Ford Fiesta, and we did our own driving. This is a very, very typical sight that you see as we travel along in the Bavarian area. I'm sure many of your ancestors came from this Bavarian area of Western Germany. Western Germany in this area is very typical, with the castles in the backgrounds and the red-tiled roofs of the small towns all around there. One of the agriculture products that are grown in this area are sugar beets. Now, most of the farmers dug the sugar beets by hand, but this fellow here had his own sugar beet harvester with a tractor. Sugar beets are harvested. The beet itself is ground to a pulp. It's cooked. The syrup is extracted for human consumption many times. The pulp of that beet is then used for feed for cattle, as well as the tops are used for silage. One of the places we wanted to travel was to Schwarzenau. This is where the Brethren had their beginning in 1708. This is the Eder River where the first Brethren were baptized. It's very close to the spot on the left where those trees begin. The reason many of the Brethren could stay in that area for quite a while was because it's pretty much protected. It's kind of a valley between mountains all around it. It's a very serene sight, very beautiful. We stayed at the Kassel Gasthaus. Harold Martin, I don't know, maybe some of you do know him, acquainted with him and his wife, led quite a few tours of Brethren Heritage tours as well as tours into Israel. But he was contemplating a tour into Schwarzenau, and he wanted to make some arrangements. Now, they were at this Kassel Gasthaus some years before, but they couldn't converse with the people because they spoke German. And so the way the trip began actually was that he told me that he wanted to go to Schwarzenau to arrange for another tour, for another trip there with a group of people. But he needed an interpreter. And so I speak fluent German. And so I agreed with him, consented to go along with him and be an interpreter. And so I was interpreter between these two ladies and him. We had a wonderful time with them. When we arrived, it was late in the evening, but we hadn't stopped for supper, and they found out that we didn't have supper. So they decided they were going to make us supper, which was not really part of the lodging fee. They made us Wiener Schnitzel. I don't know if any of you have ever heard of Wiener Schnitzel. It's veal steak pounded with flour and fried with new potatoes and new fresh peas. They were delicious. This is our little Ford Fiesta in the center part there. I'm not a Ford man, but that car almost convinced me to go that way. It was very economical, very good. One of the things that you young fellows especially would appreciate about Germany, I'm sure, is the fact that on their autobahns or their superhighways, they have no speed limits. Just as fast as your car will go, that's how fast you travel. And the BMWs and some of the bigger automobiles, they could go up to 120, 130 miles an hour. And we could get this Ford Fiesta going at about 90. That was top speed, 90 or 95. When you travel down these super highways, these autobahns, at one point especially, I was driving and I had that Ford Fiesta going pretty good speed. We were going about 90 miles an hour, and there was a truck ahead of me. I looked in my rearview mirror and I looked back down the road and I saw about 2 or 3 miles, or about a mile back, there was a car coming, but I thought, well, I'll surely make it around before he comes. So I started passing the truck, and before I ever got around, that guy was in back of me blowing his horn. Get out of the road. Another view of the same area from the other side of Schwarzenau and the Eder River. Now, they call it a river over there. Of course, over here, we might just call it a creek. We've traveled across the Autobahns, and now we're entering into Austria, along the Danube River. Here again, you see a castle on the hillside there, and we're looking into the area called Mühlviertel, the area that we lived in when we first came into Austria, but we lived for about a year before we had to cross that bridge. But just a little background on the castles. There's a lot of castles, and I'm sure you've seen pictures of castles in Germany and Austria and many of the European countries. The idea behind the castle is that it was owned by either, if it was a huge castle, it might have been a king or a baron or a grof. This particular one was owned by a grof. Now, what is a grof? A grof is a during the medieval ages, he was a huge landowner. He was not huge, I should say, a landowner of a lot of acreage. He may not have been huge. But they would build these castles either above a road or above a river, as in this case. And any traffic that would come along that road or would travel across from his land would be stopped. And they would have to pay a tax in order to travel on. And so they became very wealthy just simply from extracting this tax or this custom as they did. The Danube River, as we see it here, and I'm sure many of you have heard of the Blue Danube. As you can see, it isn't always blue. It was a gray, dark, dreary day, and so the Danube River is not blue. But we are standing on the bridge that we crossed over where the Russian guard stopped us. And as I told you, the penalty for...
Thank you for listening to this message. We trust that it has been a blessing to you. If you would like additional sermons or a catalog, please visit our website at effortofministries.org. Call us toll-free at 855-557-7902 or write to us at Effort of Ministries, 400 West Main Street, Suite 1, Ephrata, Pennsylvania, 17522. You are welcome to copy this message for free distribution. This ministry is supported by your donations. May the Lord Jesus bless you.